You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, presented by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool.
I want to be the title sponsor. What's it going to cost?
I think around 10 million.
Yeah, I that's a bit out of my budget.
I have the impression that we are in the place where we have to be now.
Greg had a really bad back all last week. So we caught up on your podcast with me giving him a back massage and him listening to you guys.
That's a wonderful image.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're at Lord's, the home of cricket. Fantastic stadium. Not the cricket season, is it? It's the start of winter. Pitch is looking very green at the moment. And we are here for the London Sports Writing Festival, the third year of this event. I think we've been involved one way or another in all three, haven't we?
I think so. That is Lionel Burney. I'm Richard Moore. And we're also rejoined by our old amigo, yeah. Daniel Freib.
Hello. How's it going?
Daniel, you're back from Berlin. How's it going?
It's all right. Yeah, fine.
Well, you've been much missed by the podcast. The listeners have been a clamour for your return. You're finally back. You're back for good?
No, I wouldn't say that. In the famous words of Take That, no, I wouldn't say that I'm back for good. But you want me back. You want me back for good.
We do want you back for good. Trying to remember the other lyric.
Is my lipstick mark still on the coffee cup?
Well, I'll have to ask Rob Hatch about that. I don't know, the home of cycling. But Daniel, you've been in Berlin. It's kind of appropriate because you've been working on a book. Yes. We'll not say too much more about that, but you've been deep in the bowels of various places and meeting
the fangs of a project
dangling on a tooth. Yeah. Going well?
Wouldn't say that.
Have you been following cycling while you've been away?
Wouldn't say that either. But yeah, a little bit. Always.
So we're here today. We're doing a cycling podcast live event at Lord's, part of the London Sports Writing Festival, as Lionel said. That will be released as a Friends of the Podcast special. Number 10, I think. We've got two coming up.
That'll be number 11. Number 10 is coming imminently, well, in a week or so.
And which is, can we say what that is?
Oh, I suppose we can do, yeah. I went to see Adam and Simon Yates, and we have an extended interview with the Yates brothers, Orica Green Edge riders, just come to the end of their second year as professionals, and I went to see them in Lancashire, where they lived during the off-season.
You had a puncture en route, didn't you, Lionel? But you still made it.
I did, yeah.
Heroically.
A puncture on the M62, had to call for support. I just stood in the inside lane with my arm in the air.
Neutral service.
Waiting for the Mavic team car to come and... Well, it was a yellow. It was an AA van. They're yellow, aren't they?
You didn't borrow the vehicle of a rival team member, did you?
And rival podcast.
20, and get a 20-second... Was it a 20-second penalty?
Two minutes.
Or was it?
Yeah.
No, I left in plenty of time, so I actually wasn't late despite the hour delay getting a spare wheel put on. So, yeah, that was a fairly eventful. But they were in good form, and people who have signed up to the Friends of the Podcast scheme will be able to listen to that around about the end of November, I think we're putting that out.
So you can still become a friend of the podcast for 2015 at thecyclingpodcast.com. That will give you access to 11 special podcasts. Mobile access coming very, very soon. That is being worked on, and it will be obviously fully up and running for 2016. Details of our 2016 Friends scheme will also be announced very soon. But continuing a bit of a theme this off-season, this is a bit of a different podcast. We had Sean Kelly last week, Geraint Thomas the previous week. Next week, a special report from the Basque Country from me. I've just come back from San Sebastian. But this week we're doing a cycling literature special, which is appropriate given that we're here at the Sports Writing Festival. So we're going to look at a few cycling books. We've got Ed Pickering talking about his book published this year, The Yellow Jersey Club, which is a book about the winners of the Tour de France, the members of that Yellow Jersey Club. And we've got Brendan Gallagher as well, who's written a chapter for the new cycling anthology on Hemingway and cycling. So we've got him talking about Hemingway, really interesting. He did a lot of research for that. And also speaking more generally about cycling books. And the three of us will come back at the end. So let's hear first from Brendan, then from Ed, and then again from Brendan. Brendan Gallagher. We're going to talk literature and cycling literature. Your chapter in the cycling anthology is all about Ernest Hemingway and his relationship with cycling. A deeper relationship than is reflected in his written work, sadly. Tell us a little bit about the chapter and where the idea came from.
Well, the idea, essentially, I'm a Hemingway fan. I've always enjoyed his writing, studied him at university along with Orwell and other people like that. I was always aware of this link with cycling. There's always been there's been one or two tantalising passages in his actual published works. He was clearly a cycling fan for 3 or 4 years in his Paris years. That comes out in correspondence all over the place. And I just wanted to see, you know, how he approached it, what he made of it, and possibly, you know, that tantalising question, why he didn't write a definitive piece on cycling, or at least he doesn't appear to have done. But of course, you know, he left manuscripts all over Europe during his rather chaotic life.
So you think there might be a hidden manuscript somewhere?
Well, there's always that slight hope. I mean, he definitely, or his first wife, Hadley, lost his entire work, bar two pieces, in the first 3 years of his time in Paris. And that, you know, as writers can relate to that, that must have been absolutely traumatic. And that was right in the middle of his...
Did he not back up? Did he not have it on the hard drive?
I don't know how these guys managed it in those years. I mean, everything... I mean, he hand-wrote at that stage. Yeah. Everything was handwritten. But yes, his wife managed to lose everything, and who knows, somewhere in that bag in a carriage in Gare de Lyon might have been a really big piece on cycling. And of course, he wrote notes as he moved around the world. And again, 20 years later, he found the Ritz Hotel in Paris phoned him up and said, "Look, we've got a trunk here full of your stuff. You left it here in the 1930s." And in that was definitely one of the passages that he did write about on cycling, which appeared in A Movable Feast, which is possibly, arguably, his best book, certainly his best later book.
Yeah, A Movable Feast is his memoir of his time in Paris, and it is fantastic. And there is that passage in there about cycling. You know, he went to the track in Paris, but he was also, it seemed, fascinated by road cycling. And he talked about intending one day to turn his hand to writing about cycling, but he feared that in English it wouldn't be the same, that it almost, the sport belonged to the French and the French language. Do you think that was the obstacle?
I think it probably was. I mean, he's an extraordinary writer and a very, very clever guy, certainly on literary subjects. And I think he realised that he had limitations here. You know, he loved the sport, he loved the scene, the milieu, but his French wasn't great. His Spanish was much better than his French. And, you know, cycling is a complicated sport, as we know, and he was struggling to understand all the nuances, and he feared that some of the French writers, the Spanish writers, you know, had the up on him here, and that they knew the sport better than he did, and that wouldn't really be acceptable in his mind. But you can see him straining at least wanting to do a big cycling book, and he warned his big friend John Dos Passos off. You know, they were talking about cycling. It was quite clear. Hemingway made him quite clear that this is my domain. You know, I'm going to be writing the stuff on cycling. You steer clear of this. But alas, he never really did do the big treatment.
Famously, Hemingway was drawn to sports, bullfighting, hunting, fishing, and war. Not so much a sport, but these pursuits that were expressions of manliness, manhood. What do you think appealed to him about cycling? What was it that same thing of it being such a tough, brutal sport and almost a test of manliness, if you like?
Yeah, I think it's all of that. You know, he was a man of extremes. He liked man in extremis, at his physical limit, at his mental limit. He liked geography, topography, mountainsides, deserts, heat, cold. He loved all that. So there's an instant appeal there. The other thing, what he absolutely loved, was the inside track and the feeling of a little closed society. And his other lengthy passage that he did actually write about cycling was in A Farewell to Arms, where he stumbles upon the penultimate day of the Pays de Basque, the Tour de Pays de Basque, and he writes quite a lengthy passage here on what he sees and what he observes. And what he sees and observes, to me, is almost like a scene from the mess of a company at war. You know, it's a band of men, perhaps they've come back from the front, you know, 10 miles back the front, there's an evening of wine, women and song. There's a couple of sort of women with them, but it's not quite, I think he says he wasn't sure who they were with, who they belonged to, actually, was the expression he used. There's a lot of jargon, slang, inside chat, knowing winks, bawdy humour. And there was also that element about, the race wasn't exactly fixed, but they were all in this together. This was a show, this was an entertainment. They would all profit from it. They would all get some money at the end of it. And everybody knew that, and everybody knew how it worked. And I mean, that is definitely his one polished piece on writing. The other piece was his sort of notes on a night at the track circuit. This was his sort of polished take on road racing. I think it's very informative how he talks about it. This is the scene that he absolutely loves, this inside track.
We're going to talk about Edward Pickering with new book, latest book, The Yellow Jersey Club. Hello, Edward.
Hi, Lionel.
Well, first of all, could you just talk me through how the idea came up? Obviously, the Tour de France is the biggest bike race in the world. It's not a huge stretch of the imagination to write a book about the Tour, but to focus on the individual winners. You know, where did that idea and the inspiration for that come from?
I've wanted to write the book for quite a few years. The idea of looking at the Tour de France through the winners seemed quite an interesting one. It's after I watched the presentation of the green blazer to the, is that the right word, the green blazer to the winner of the US Masters Golf Championship. It kind of very, it happens in a, the presentation for the US Masters golf tournament happens in a kind of wooden lined room, and
it's a log cabin, isn't it?
It could be a log cabin, yeah. A wooden lined room as we know it in the UK. And it kind of made me think that the winners of that competition belonged to a very exclusive club, and I easily transposed that to the winners of the Tour de France. And I had a little practice run on this book for your cycling anthology, when I wrote a chapter called the Tour Winners Club, when I wrote about Bernard Thevenet and Jan Janssen, who are two winners I am quite heavily identified with and enjoyed. And I kind of had a little practice run at why it was important to write about the Tour winners then. And then decided that it would make a good book. A chapter per winner on the last 20 or so winners. And but not centred on it so much on what happened when they won the race, like in terms of the race unfolding, more from the personalities and the, you know, having a personality-led account of the Tour winners seemed to be quite interesting.
What struck me was that it starts after Eddie Merckx's retirement. If you like, Eddie Merckx still retains this mystique as the greatest ever, and yet the book picks up the Tour de France's illustrious history at the point that he is no longer a current figure. And we kick off with Bernard Thevenet, who won the 1975 Tour. Was that a conscious decision? Why pick a particular time frame, or did you pick a particular time frame, or am I just reading too much into it there and thinking that because it's 2015 now, we've gone back to 1975 and it just sort of neatly wraps up as 40 years?
Yeah, it's more of a happy accident, really, although now that accident happened, I have rationalised it and made it look deliberate. I didn't really want to write about Merckx because he seems to me to be from another era. I wanted to have the book in the modern era. I'll admit, originally I wanted to find all the living winners, but as soon as I tried to get an interview with Ferdinand Kubler, who won the Tour in the early 50s, who's still alive, he's very frail, very ill, and I had a few conversations with his wife, and she made it clear that I wasn't going to get an interview, so I couldn't just do the living winners of the Tour. So I thought the best thing to do is do it chronologically. The Merckx era ending in 1975 kind of fits in with two things. First of all, my life as a cycling fan, I started watching the Tour in the mid-80s. I was born in 1973, so it seemed quite symmetrical on that front. And also, when I counted them up, there were 21 winners, which is the same number of stages in the Tour de France. And I thought, well, that seems a good number to go for. And the third reason, which is, you know, less important, because I think there are two very good books on Eddie Merckx, recently written by Daniel Freeb and William Fotheringham, and I felt that they'd done the subject justice. It would be good to start with Bernard Thevenet, who people know a little bit less.
One of the chapters that I was most familiar with and enjoyed the most was the Laurent Fignon one, not just because we both played golf with him once, and you do mention that in the chapter, but because you managed to kind of peel away at the sort of the layers of a man who struck me always as being singularly unsuited for a sport as kind of tough and, you know, examinatory as cycling is. He makes a point in his own book that he wasn't just the man who lost the 1989 tour, but he won it twice. But that just gets swept away. And your last line, I think, mentions that, you know, it just sort of echoes back to that point, that he wasn't just the man who lost the most famous tour of all time, or certainly the closest tour of all time, but that he won it twice. The fact that he sort of passed away, did that give... There's a slightly melancholic sort of edge to that chapter. I don't know whether that's just because of the way I was reading it, or whether that was intentional, or, you know, what you felt, but there was just something about the fact that Fignon had almost this sort of tragic relationship with the tour and died very young. Of all of the people, I think, other than Marco Pantani, Marco Pantani is the only other person on your list who's no longer with us. Seems to add something to it for me.
Yeah, I was melancholic when I wrote Fignon, and I'm melancholic when I think about him for quite a few reasons. First of all, I knew him a bit better because when he came over to London, we spent a bit of time together. I had a nice interview with him, and he, you know, you'll back me up on this. He was great company when we took him for a round of golf, and he was great company, but he was also very ordinary company. He was actually he was a nice man, and I've, you know, it's a shame that he died tragically young. Really, I think he was 50 when he died, and that's too young. And I did get the impression that in the course of his life he did have a lot of kind of joie de vivre, and he kind of embraced life, not just in terms of his cycling, but when we took him for a meal in London, and he, you know, talked to me and Phil O'Connor, the photographer who came with us, about how much he loved food and loved entertaining with his friends. And he did say that he liked getting large groups of friends together to cook for them, and for just to be together. The food was a conduit for the conversation. And I asked him whether he was kind of the life and soul of the party, or whether it was a talker or a listener in these situations. He said, you know, he preferred to sit back and listen. And again, like with all these people, we get presented with a quite simple description of the man. You know, Fignon, he's the kind of grumpy, bad-tempered guy who lost the 1989 Tour de France. But he's not. He is that, but he's also the entertainer who likes spending time with friends. He's the man who won two Tours de France, who won a Giro d'Italia as well, and he's got more layers to him than people give him credit for. And I think, having spent time with him, I liked him a lot on a personal level, and that's why I think, you know, I was quite sad about writing about him, because, you know, I liked him a lot, and it's a shame that he passed away.
You said earlier on that you were itching to write some chapters, and you got on with those first. I mean, in terms of working on the book, your cast list is set for you. You didn't have any decisions to make there, other than perhaps the conundrum over Lance Armstrong and certain other years. How did you actually go about it? I mean, what struck me was the depth of research and other reading that you've done to give yourself that kind of... If we were to talk about this as a sort of a stew, you made a very rich stock by reading a heck of a lot of material. I mean, was that an enjoyable process? Was that what you did first? I mean, how did you kind of go about putting these 21 chapters together?
Yeah, enjoyable, no, because it's a big job and I want to do it justice. So it wasn't enjoyable because there was a huge amount of work to do, and I put myself under a lot of pressure to, you know, make sure that in each chapter there was something new, fresh, original, and that each chapter would stand on its own as a piece of work. So in terms of the research, I've been watching cycling since the mid-80s, and I've read a lot about it, and I counted my cycling book trees, and I've got over 200 cycling books and numerous cycling magazines, and I went through everyone with a fine tooth comb. So I spent quite a lot of time holed up in my study at home, reading through all the material I could find on each of these 21 individuals. And I made 21 Word documents and made notes on each one. Once I'd finished with the kind of secondary sources, the books and the magazines, I started speaking to people and speaking to the actual tour winners themselves. I got interviews with some and not others. Started speaking to them, started speaking, and this is just as important, speaking to people who knew them. Teammates, rivals, friends, other riders, And started building up a picture. And as the picture of each rider started emerging, I started working out what the structure of each chapter would be and what was important. And this wasn't all happening 21 chapters at a time or doing it in order. You know, I didn't really start on some chapters till after I'd finished others, but that's the base kind of structure of my research. Once I'd done the interviews and transcribed them and thought about it a bit more, I started writing. And then I wrote the Bradley Wiggins chapter first. It seemed to me a good place to start, because I think Wiggins brings... There's something about Wiggins and, funnily enough, Lance Armstrong as well, that I think that they've brought out the best in a lot of cycling writers. I think that some of the writing about Lance Armstrong and Wiggins has been, irrespective of what you think about the riders themselves or irrespective of what you whether you agree with the writer or not, the writing about those two riders has been really, really strong. So I thought, I'll start with Wiggins. And I had the research done, and I knew what I wanted to say. And also, I've watched Wiggins a lot since the first time. I met him for the first time in 2005 or 2006. I think maybe even earlier than that, actually. It seemed quite immediate to me, so I tried to get that into the chapter, and that's why I started his chapter with a kind of eyewitness account of me, the first time I really kind of understood what Bradley Wiggins the cyclist was about, which is about this kind of the absolutely metronomic, perfect, beautiful form that he has on a bike. Everything that Bradley Wiggins has achieved has been that's been the foundation of it all, and that's why I started my chapter. So the main thing was, I didn't want 21 identikit on a profiles where you start when they're born, and then they learn how to ride a bike, and then all this stuff happens, and then they win the Tour de France, and isn't it marvellous? I didn't want that. I wanted each chapter to stand alone as a piece of work, and also not to get repetitive. It's very important. It wouldn't take long to get bored if I'd told the same story 21 times, just changed the names. So with Thevenet, who's chapter one, what's important with Bernard Thevenet is that he is a child of, you know, what's known as La France Profonde, which is kind of, he comes from a very kind of generic hamlet deep in rural France, right in the centre of France. And I actually know this area very well. I spent a year living in a town called Moulins, which is very close to where Bernard Thevenet grew up. It's the next prefecture over. So I know the landscape of his upbringing and the kind of rural milieu that he grew up in is part and parcel of who he is. And he's also very popular in France, he's very popular when he was a rider for that. You know, the French are suckers for a kind of... They preferred Raymond Poulidor to Jacques Anquetil in the 60s because Poulidor was the kind of uncomplicated child of rural France, whereas Anquetil was seen as a city slicker, and they came down on the side of Poulidor. And so I started the Thevenet chapter with a description of Le Guidon, which is where he's from, because that's the root of everything with Thevenet. With the other chapters, and with Greg LeMond, I wanted to symbolise that he was a symbol of cycling modernising itself. He was the first to introduce bigger salaries, to introduce technological change. His career coincided with it, and he embraced a lot of it. And so I kind of compare that with the cultural changes that happened in the 1980s, and to me that Le Monde is he symbolises the 1980s for me, because the 1980s were in cycling a period of great technological and cultural change. So each chapter I've tried to make specific to the rider in question, and not to just tell the same story that's already been told about each guy.
And do you have a favourite of all the 21, one that you in hindsight think stands as the strongest or the best, or just the one that you feel sort of proudest of?
I don't know. I mean I do have my favourite. I have favourites for different reasons. I've got, you know, the winners I would most like to go for a beer with, and I give them the kind of the beer test, like, who would I like to go for a beer with? Those people aren't necessarily the most interesting or the best at cycling. And so it's hard to answer that, because I also have personal prejudices, you know, from my own life, that, you know, I grew up watching cycling as a teenager in the 1980s, so I've got a real soft spot for Eno, LeMond, Roach, Delgado. On the other hand, I found Delgado's Tourin was actually a real... It was a bit of a dud as far as Tour de France goes. It wasn't very interesting. It was,
as you say, it's probably the least interesting thing about his entire relationship with the Tour.
Exactly, yeah. Delgado is actually a lot more interesting as a loser than he was as a winner. But yeah, that's mostly what I've written about, because that's Pedro Delgado. So in terms of a favourite, I like Greg LeMond a lot, purely because he was a childhood hero of mine. He's not my hero now, but he was a hero when I was a child. That leaves an impression on you always. I think it always will do. Plus, when I interviewed him, he is absolute gold for a journalist, because he's generous with his time and insight. Like I said in the book, I was interviewing him. One of his answers went on for 38 minutes, and that's Greg LeMond. It's not necessarily the answer that I was looking for or anything to do with the question I asked, but that's LeMond, and I like him a lot because he is a great guy, and he also was badly treated by cycling, not by everybody, but by a lot of people in cycling for a long time, so I've got sympathy for him as well. I like Bradley Wiggins as well, but I find him interesting. I find him compelling. I think he's got a fascinating character, and he seems to have a relationship with the British, not just cycling public, but more so with the British sporting public and general public, that no other cyclist has managed to replicate, not even Mark Cavendish. And there's something about Wiggins' character which I find magnetic. I don't think we'd be best mates if he wasn't a great cyclist. I don't think I'd be best mates with him or anything.
You're not best mates with him, are you?
I'm not best mates with Bradley Wiggins. I'd scarcely go so far to say we're mates. But I find him compelling, but that's not the same as liking him on a personal level. I mean, he's got a magnetic personality which I can't resist, writing about and finding interesting. And I liked, you know, people like Lucien Van Impe and Bernard Thévenet. They're old enough not to have egos anymore, and they're great to talk to, because there is a lack of ego there which you don't tend to find so much with the younger ones.
Brendan Gallagher, you picked a list last year of 10 outstanding books in your view, but what, I mean, pick a few and then ultimately pick your what you think is the best one.
Well, let me start backwards. The best book is always Geoffrey Nicholson's book, in my opinion, The Great Bike Race. And on so many levels, to be able to write like that, I'm so envious. Just a beautiful writer, and you can go back to that book every single time and find a little phrase or a little nuance which you hadn't picked up before. It's absolutely gorgeously written. So I absolutely love that book. I also love it in its innocence, because we know that the Tour de France is got many facets, and some of them, you know, don't bear close scrutiny. But it was written in the mid-70s. Doping wasn't considered quite so heinous that you know, you'd get a 10-minute fine, I think, and 250 francs if you got caught. So he didn't dwell on it. He didn't ignore it, unlike some people think he ignored it. But he didn't dwell on it. He saw the race from the roadside almost. That's the spectacle that everybody sees every day. The 1 million people on the road. You know, they might read about the doping at 9 o'clock in L'Équipe, but by 10:30 they're on the roadside. The kids are having a day off. They're having lunch with the parents and the grandparents. All that stuff. And he never loses sight of that. And he never loses sight of the racing and the characters. So it's like a sort of annual renewal to read that book.
You mentioned Sam Abt earlier, and Sam Abt has written a chapter about that book. Sam Abt covered that tour as well and knew Geoffrey Nicholson, but Sam's written about it in the new cycling anthology, and that's volume 6. And he does pick out a few lines, as you say. He does have a turn of phrase. Anybody who knows these writers will instantly recognise it. If Eddie Merckx says the Belgian Grand Seigneur of cycle racing, the most successful, most versatile and richest cyclist of all times, in strength of character, the noblest Roman of them all. He has high-cheeked, graven features of a totem pole, and they break into laughter just about as often. This I love this one, actually. Francesco Moser, a handsome downhill racer from the Dolomites, who always carries with him, like a whiff of aftershave, a touch of the expensive glamour of winter sports.
Absolutely.
Freddie Martins, the fastest sprinter in road racing, climbs as though he were pushing a barrel ahead of him. That's absolutely Spot on.
Absolutely. And he sort of writes effortlessly. He brings you into the trip. You know, you're on the road trip with him. You're sitting in the back of the old car. Phil Liggett's driving. David Sanders is probably, you know, navigating and whatever. And Jeff's in the back there and is probably tucking into his baguette and just observing and watching. And it's a delightful book. And it's not hardcore. It's not, you know, there are all sorts of cycling books and they all have their qualities, you know. And you've got the mea culpas and the exposés. And, that, you know, these are terrific books and they bring the truth to the reader. But, you know, it's probably an exception, but not all of them are that brilliant books to read. You know, they're quite hard. They're not particularly fluent and literary. And you read them and you absorb it and you put them on the shelf and you probably only go back to them when you need to check those facts. I mean, I would say an exception. That would be Paul Kimmage's Rough Ride, which is not only a sort of really hard look at the sport as it was then, but also a beautifully written book. You know, again, great turns of phrase. So you've got those sort of books. You've got the really well-written biographies, or mainly biographies, actually. Autobiographies are quite difficult, I think. But the biographies, and you've got Will Fotheringham's Tom Simpson. You've got your brilliant work on Robert Miller, which, you know, again, it's something you go back to because there's a nuance there always. There's something which you hadn't really absorbed first time.
I don't go back to it.
Are you like me, that you find it impossible to read anything you've ever written?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very difficult, isn't it? I think 5 years is normally the distance you have to put between writing something and reading it. Mm. So that's another... And I think cycling is very well served with those sort of biographical type books. I think, you know, there's some terrific stuff out there. And then you've got... the Woody Allen, who's Sam Apt. You know, I mean, I'm just such a convert and a fan of his writing, and it's his style is he deals mainly in the sort of 1500 word, 2000 word short story. Mm. And it's always not quite what you think it's going to be. He starts off on the subject. Mm. He'll start serious and then go funny, or he'll start funny and then go serious. Mm. And he dives into all sorts of subject matter. I mean, he had me crying once. I can't remember exactly which book it was in, but he wrote a bit about, you know, the departure of the circus. And what it was, he was covering a race, and about 4 or 5 days into the race, he had to go. He couldn't cover it anymore. And he woke up one morning, and the circus was leaving town, and he was on his own having a coffee, and that was it. He was on his own, and all his mates had gone, all the riders had gone, all the mechanics. And that in itself was quite poignant, but I happened to be reading it on a day I was covering the first women's tour, and I'd had almost exactly the same experience. I'd arrived at a hotel at 9:30 that night, beautiful May night, and the car park was absolutely buzzing. There was about 9-10 team cars, floodlights, there was the power hoses, there was the mechanics, there was people ordering up food, food was coming in, somebody rigged up some sounds. You know, and I'd squeezed in and parked up. And then the next morning, I was bailing out for a day or two, and I made quite a late start by my standards, got up, leisurely breakfast, read the paper. About 9:15, I went out, and my car was the only car in the car park. It was the only vehicle. And just 10 hours earlier, that had been like a village, and it had gone. It was just... And the transient feeling of that was extraordinary. And then to read Sam put that into words around that time was... I mean, it almost brings tears to your eyes.
He's the master as well of the dry, you know, dry humour. You mentioned the comparison with Woody Allen is very good. He's a similar deadpan delivery in person, but in print as well. I remember an introduction to a story he was writing about Axel Merckx on his retirement, saying, you know, Axel Merckx, part of a famous cycling dynasty who between them have 526 professional victories. And of course, his father, Eddie, had 525 professional victories.
Well, I shamelessly borrowed from that in one of the pieces I wrote, because I once, possibly the highlight of my journalistic career, was spending the day with Peter O'Toole and Richard Harris at a rugby day. And I picked up Harris from the Savoy. We were heading for Twickenham for a Munster match, and then we picked up O'Toole. So from a salubrious hotel in Richmond. So I had these two reprobates in the.
When was this?
This is 2000, for the Heineken Cup finals. I had these two reprobates in the back of the car with me, And I looked around and I thought, I've got a little crack here, but I'm not sure if I should use this. I said, okay, I'll go for it. I said, Richard and Peter, do you realise that between us we've got 9 Oscar nominations in this car? And luckily they took it fairly well.
Anyway, back onto cycling. Well, so the Great Bike Race is the best one, but a couple of others, and then this year, 2015, this podcast is going to go out before Christmas, so Christmas ideas for people. What books are the standouts this year?
I've been pretty busy this year, so I'm just tucking into most of the cycling books now. I mean, the latest David Miller book, I'm halfway through that. I really like that. That's coming along beautifully. It's a sort of year in the life of, but with knobs and a sort of deluxe version. So I'm really enjoying that a lot. What else have we had this year? There's a very good book, Women in Cycling, rather than Women's Cycling. And that, I think, is put together by Festina Girl. And that is really good. I've just finished that one. It's 30 essays on with about women in cycling. And there's some very strong issues on that. So I really enjoyed that. And, I mean, looking back over the years, where do you start, you know? I'm just trying to think the books I pull Rough Ride out quite a bit and have a read of that. You know, that's the sort of, along with the Great Bike Race, is the one you sort of have to read every year. The biographies, they're the ones I go back to. I just like to, you know, the inside track of those riders, what they did. And then, of course, as information comes out over the years, you look at it anew, don't you? What else is a... I love that approach that you did with Robert Miller about trying to track somebody down who doesn't necessarily want to be written about or seek the publicity, but at the same time has got a story to tell. And I think you started with a genre there, and any book that sets out to do that, I like and enjoy.
There's no original ideas, though, are there? I kind of copied Jonathan Coe, a great novelist, who wrote a book, a biography of B.S. Johnson, the obscure writer who committed suicide in the 70s, and he wrote a book called Like a Fiery Elephant, which is basically in search of B.S. Johnson. Obviously he's dead, so it's a bit different, but it's a similar sort of detective story, and the author is central to it. I wanted to write a biography of Robert Miller, but the problem I had was that I didn't think Robert Miller would cooperate, and it was a friend of mine who said, well, go in search of, and then you're writing about your search rather than, you know, the sort of definitive biography, I suppose. So it gives you a new angle on it, which you're always going to be able to... You've always got a story there, even if you don't find your quarry in the end.
I think all biographies are detective stories in a funny sort of way, and it's just whether you choose to present them as a detective story, which then becomes a story in itself, or you do all the research and you say, okay, this is what I've got, and now I'm going to write that. So that's an interesting one. And, of course, the other development in recent years is the sort of participatory book where you become the person riding, you know. You become the person reliving the famous 1914 Giro.
That's Tim Moore's book.
Yeah, I mean, now that is an entirely wonderful book, very funny, very amusing. But and that works on quite a few levels. That's a history, but it's also a personal adventure.
Geronimo, it's called.
Geronimo, really enjoyed that, and it's part of a... I think we're going to get more and more of those books. In fact, I think that's Tim not gone off and done the old peace race routes and round it, Eastern Europe and Lithuania and Estonia and Russia and all sorts.
Yeah, she's honourable mentions offer To Hell on a Bike, Riding Paris-Roubaix by Ian McGregor, similar book, history of Paris-Roubaix, which came out this year, coupled with Ian's attempts to ride the Sportif. It's a sort of new type of book. Tim Moore sort of pioneered that in a sense with French Revolutions a few years ago. So he rode the route of the Tour de France, and he's a very, very funny comic writer who's written a lot of travel books, but cycling, certainly French Revolution, was very popular.
And of course, I think we ought to doff our caps as well to someone like Herbie Sykes, who does that really sort of hardcore investigative piece recently about the East German regime, the peace race, and the rider who managed to escape to the West. Now, you know, I sort of tipped the cap in a couple of ways there. I mean, not only was it a magnificent story, but the detective work that went on there to access the Stasi files, to talk to the people involved, and to either be fluent in the language or find somebody who was fluent in the language to translate everything. I mean, a mighty piece of work.
The Race Against the Stasi, that came out 2014, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the best books of last year, wasn't it? I think it might have even won some sort of award for that, and rightly so. It was a beautifully put together piece of work.
Nicole Cook's book, I think you were a little bit involved in that as well, were you?
Well, yes, and only in that the manuscript came in way too long. It was all Nicole's work, and then I applaud her for that. It was fantastic, but it was too long. It was 200,000 words, and it had to be subbed down to, you know, 115, 120, and restructured a bit. But I would say that was a super sub job rather than a writing job. I mean, I contributed nothing in terms of content. I just reduced the content and tried to. And I thought that was a very good book. As I read through it and sort of worked on it, there was some very strong passages, and some. One of the particularly good aspects of that book was, rarely have I understood tactics better than when Nicole's trying to explain them. I mean, she really brings you into a race in a way that I hadn't experienced before.
You ghost wrote Bradley Wiggins' first autobiography. How can you tell us a bit about how that process works? How collaborative is it?
Very collaborative, and ghosting is an absolute art, and I wouldn't claim to have mastered it in any way. I've also ghosted Brian O'Driscoll, and in fact I ghosted a second Brad book, and I've got another couple of ghosting books in the pipeline. It's you've got to eat humble pie when you ghost. You're not the star. It has to be the voice of the subject matter. I mean, it really has to be the voice, language, and terminology. You can't be inputting your language and your terminology and your thoughts. So that, you have to sit back and almost go into neutral. You have to go into neutral, get everything down, write it as best you can in the voice of the subject, and then it goes back to the subject. He or she refines it, sends it back to you, you send it back. It's quite a long process, but it's well worth it. Yeah, if you can get it right. And with Brad, for example, he's not a difficult voice to get. I mean, Brad is a huge character, but it is also important you get that voice, because everybody knows what it's like. Yeah. Everybody will know if he said it or somebody else, or if you're writing it. Yeah. So you're under pressure there, but he is a fairly easy voice to get. So I quite enjoy ghosting. I mean, it is unparalleled access to some of the greats. And that, you know, as a journalist, as a writer, as a sports fan, is, you know, wonderful. You can't buy that. But it's quite a tough job, and it's not easy always to get it right.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool. Pair your power meter with over 800 workouts and 80 training plans to make you a faster cyclist. Visit trainerroad.com/TCP to try Trainer Road risk-free for 30 days.
Okay, you heard there our extended Trainer Road jingle after we heard from Brendan Gallagher, Ed Pickering. And Trainer Road, thank you very much to them for sponsoring us throughout the winter. Very much appreciated helping to keep this weekly podcast free. Thank you. And we've been following our Trainer Road programs. Well, I haven't. I've had 2 weeks off. I've been in San Sebastian, and I did rent a bike out there, and I rode the bike quite a lot. But I didn't follow the Trainer Road programs, which was difficult out in the road. But it was very hilly, so I think I've come back in decent shape. But Lionel, you've been religiously following the program. When I say decent shape, I mean it's all relative.
Relatively. Yeah, yeah. I've been following the program. As you know, it's not really my bag. Any hard work, really. Not really hard physical work, just not made for it. I'm just haven't got the willpower. And so I was really nervous about being able to stick to this program of 3 rides a week on the indoor trainer, which I find miserable, really. I make no bones about it. This is not what I like doing at all with my time. But 8-9 sessions in, I haven't missed a session yet. I'm on top of it. I feel like starting to make small improvements.
I had 10 days of it. I was quite enjoying it. I quite enjoy the way the sessions are structured. You don't get bored. Even things I was quite sceptical about, like one-legged cycling, has been fascinating for me, because I had a hip replacement a few years ago, and I did a lot of rehab afterwards. It was supposed to get my body rebalanced. But what I learned from this is actually it hasn't. My left leg is considerably stronger than my right leg, where the operation was. So it for me, it's been really interesting, and it shows me that I've got work to do. Daniel, I think you've been observing your housemate, Rob Hatch, who's been following the program as well.
Yeah, I've seen him a couple of times. Last week, so I've only been back a week, regularly returned to the home of cycling to find Hatch swimming in his own perspiration and growling encouragement at himself in the style of, what was Rocky Balboa's old trainer? Sort of along those lines.
Apollo Reed. That was his nemesis, wasn't it, I think?
I'm not sure. And he's a very delicate flower, generally, is Rob, in all aspects of life, I would venture to say. And he seems to have a lot of ailments, a lot of complaints. He's worried about his form. He's worried about his rivals, his competitors. He's worried about his crooked pedaling style. So it's an emotional roller coaster, even just observing him trying to complete this program, what it has been over the last few days.
Well, we've got a chat coming up this week, Lionel, with Chad Timmerman, the coach at Trainer Road, we're just going to get a bit of feedback from him and talk about what's coming up, and we'll hear from him in a future podcast. But thanks again to Trainer Road. We also want to say a few more thank yous, because this last week we won Best Podcast at the Cycling Media Awards, which was very nice, and you were there, Lionel, to accept the award on our behalf.
Yeah, I didn't mention either of you, but I did accept the award, which we're very pleased to have won.
Where is it?
Well, Nigel Brown has it in his office.
Shouldn't it be shared between us?
Well, I thought I'd give it to him because he's London-based, and then you two could go and have a look at the award, and maybe he will let you sort of touch it and pick it up. But perhaps we ought to have it on a rotation, 4 months each.
Yeah. I don't know if I trust it in the home of cycling. Things get lost in the home of cycling. I don't know. How's Marco Plantani?
He seems to have shrunk, because Rob Hatch has installed in my bedroom a dehumidifier. For some reason, he seems to think this
very suspicious. You need to return home from Berlin to find a dehumidifier.
All sorts of very suspicious things have gone on. There's a dehumidifier in my room. There's one cupboard in the kitchen is full of amino acids, absolutely full of various types
doping,
of
doping
amino acids.
Are you having to sort of skirt around the oxygen tent as well?
Anyway, I'm not convinced that this dehumidifier is working, but
not working on your hair, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's for sure. But Hatch dutifully appears in my bedroom a couple of times a week to empty the dehumidifier of the water that's collected, and he pours it straight into Marco Plantani. This is what he's using to feed Marco Plantani, and I'm convinced that
that was quite admirable. I'm surprised he's not also collecting his own sweat in order to offer. This would be wonderful.
Set up the turbo trainer in your room while you've been away.
Anyway, we thought winning this award gave us a perfect excuse to do something that we should have done probably a while ago, and thank all the many people who have been of huge assistance to the Cycling Podcast. I have to say, most of these people contacted us to offer their help for free. They were listeners, and quite a few of them with expertise in different areas have just got in touch, from radio producers to people with mail shot skills, marketing skills, that kind of thing. It's been really quite overwhelming since we started to receive all these offers of help. First of all, we should thank the people who've sponsored us in 2015. Van Dessel Cycles sponsored us back at the start of the year. British Eurosport for most of the year. Jaguar, of course, for the Wiggins Our Record and the Tour de France. And Trainer Road, who are seeing us through the winter. We also want to thank Jonathan Rowe, who's a producer and really all-round tech guru. He's behind a lot of the sort of tech support that we try and offer. Nigel Brown of Dirt and Glory, Paul Scoynes, John Mooney, Alex Ady, Tom Wally, all our producers. Alice Glossop, French podcast lady, how could I forget her? Paul Shafto, also Glass Pear and 13 Senses for the music that we use in our episodes. Thank you very much to them. Jim Nicholson, thank you to him. And thank you to the Tour de France, Thomas Carreau and Christian Prudhomme in particular, friend of the podcast, Prudy. Intelligent Mobile as well, thank you to them for their tech Help and The Telegraph, who are our media partners. Thank you very much to The Telegraph. Anyone else can you think of, Lionel?
Just our listeners. Thank you very much to all the listeners, particularly the ones who give us feedback, good, bad and indifferent, via Facebook or Twitter or email. Always good to hear what the listeners are making of what we're doing.
Thank you very much. This has been an episode devoted to cycling literature. Any books that you're reading? We're going to actually offer a couple of prizes, but any books that you're reading or want to tell us about, Lionel?
The most recent cycling book I read was William Fotheringham's book about Bernard Hinault, which I enjoyed tremendously, because there's a certain sort of mystique to Hinault's character, isn't there? And he just peeled away at some of that, and a lot of the stories in there that I didn't know. So I found that really worth reading.
Daniel, I imagine you've not been reading too many general cycling books, or maybe some obscure ones.
I've been reading a lot of books in German, unfortunately, about East German doping mainly, not to give too much away. A book I always like to remind people of, because I think it's one of the best cycling books ever written, unfortunately not written by anyone in my present company, although you two have also contributed a great deal to the cycling canon, but a book that I always like to mention is The Land of Second Chances by Tim Lewis, a book about the Rwandan cycling team cycling in Rwanda. Doesn't get mentioned enough, and for my money, one of the best books that's been written on cycling in the last 10 years or so.
One of the best books, full stop, I think, written on any sport, on any subject. Actually, I was in the Basque Country last week with Eneko Garati, who runs a publisher in Spain, and he is publishing that book in Spanish. That's coming out very soon. That's the next book that will be published by him, and I was delighted to hear that, because the more people that get to read that book, the better. I think it's a terrific book.
Well, yeah, just before we wrap up, need to remind people that if they've signed up for either as a friend of the podcast, or if they've signed up to receive the Cycling Podcast weekly email bulletin, which will keep you abreast of all cycling podcast related news, if you've signed up to either of those things, in this week's newsletter, which will already be out by the time you're listening to this, there's a link to buy a copy of Sean Kelly's autobiography Hunger in paperback for just £5, which is basically a 50% discount. That's my gift to the Cycling Podcast listeners.
Another couple of gifts then. I'm going to offer a copy of my book Etape, which was published last year, to anybody who signs up, not anybody, not everybody, but one person at random will be picked, who signs up to receive our mail shot, which you can do through our website. So anybody who signs up to that will be picked at random in the next week. So somebody who signs up in the next week will win that book. Also, Ed Pickering's book, The Yellow Jersey Club, we're going to offer that as a prize. These will both be signed, I should say. We'll pick somebody who's already signed up as a friend of the podcast, or not a friend, but on the mailing list, if you know what I mean. You don't have to be a friend of the podcast to join the mailing list. So join up and stand a chance to win my book, Etape. Someone will be picked at random to win Ed's book, The Yellow Jersey Club.
We should explain how people sign up. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com and a little window will appear. Enter your email address and name, and it's as simple as that.
And you'll get a weekly newsletter with an update on what's going on, etc. So we should wrap up. We're going to get back into the normal swing of podcasting pretty soon. Obviously delighted that Daniel's back. And you'll be joining us throughout the winter, Daniel. You're not disappearing off anywhere again, are you?
No plans at the moment, but I'm unpredictable.
Open to offers.
Yes, definitely.
Right, well, listen, we're going to go and do our event in a moment. I think we've got some last-minute preparations to do. So we'll go and do that. You can hear this event as a Friends of the Podcast special in the next few weeks. But for the moment, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.